Hello, this is Chris O'Regan, and you're listening to The Sausage Factory.
Na, 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 na.
This is episode 490 of The Sausage Factory. In this episode, I interview Mariona Valls and Jordi Garcia of Mango Protocol about the design and development of Clem, a comedy horror point-and-click adventure game. Is it point-and-click? Well, you're moving around and you interact with things with the controller. So maybe it's not point-and-click, but it's an adventure game. It's very, very well-crafted. And we talk about some very interesting points about making adventure games in this day and age, because 30 years ago, the more obtuse the puzzles were, the better, according to the design of games back then. But now that can't be. Instead, you have to be more intelligent about the creation of these games. Credit the audience with some intelligence, but also respect their time. It's a delicate balance. And we delve into that in this episode. So I hope you enjoy. Listen to me talk to Mariona and Jordi about the creation of Clem. The music for this episode is by Pau Damia Riera. Now, the link to buying the full OST is on the show notes for this episode. Do check it out. And also, we've got a list of the tracks that are featured in this episode too. Hello, Jordi and Mariona.
Hello.
Hello, Chris.
Could you tell us who you are and what you do?
I go first, Mariona, for please. Example.
Yes, yes.
I'm Mariona Valls, and I am art director and co-founder of Mango Protocol, a studio from Barcelona.
And I am Jordi Garcia, one of the three co-founders too, and I am the game designer and animator and some other things, because we are indies and we are a few people and we do many, many things.
Yes. Yes, I'm sure you do. Many, many hats are worn. Mm-hmm. So, in the order, you've done it, so Mariona and Jordi, how did you make your start making video games?
Yeah, that's a really nice question, because I study fine arts, so I was trained as a classic artist, so I had no training making digital art. And it was by chance my partner, and now my husband, asked me to do a little pet project in our spare time, and that pet project like hold us our life inside, and now we are making it professional, and this is where my Mango Protocol starts as a free time thing, and now it's my job.
Nice. Jordi?
I started a bit earlier than Mariona and Javi. Javi is our third co-founder and Mariona's husband. I started some years before them. After I finished my studies, I started making mobile games, but a few years into it, I wasn't feeling really comfortable doing what I was doing, because, well, monetization strategies were a bit shady for me, so I didn't like that. And yeah, at that time, Mariona and Javi were getting ready to to start the serious business after developing Mechanica, and while they were developing Agatha Knight, which was Mango Protocol's second game. So yeah, then I joined them as game designer, and I've been with Mango Protocol ever since.
Well, next question. As creators, what do you believe are your biggest influences?
Yeah, I really love this question because we are so different between us, and because we are three people, we are like three legs from a stool, and we are on the same top. You can sit on us because our products, like, they are this base on top of us. But we came from different backgrounds and we really like different things. So as a collective, it's really difficult to answer that question. For example, we are not really, really strong or avid adventure game players. We play adventure games, of course, because I think they were a really important part of the history of video games. But maybe people must think that we are really into it, like we are super experts on the matter. But we are not. We like it as much as any other genre. And for example, I really like cozy games or more chill games, really small indie games, puzzle games, for example, mobile games also. So I gather my inspiration for all the games I play, even though they are really, really different from the things we made, and also from books, TV, movies, shows, animated series, comics. I think everything I watch and everything I enjoy in my life is a really big influence in my work as a creator. And that's my answer.
Awesome. Okay. Well, okay. Geordie, then, let's hear from your good self.
Yeah, more on the on the Mariona side of not being not having so many orthodox influences. Yeah, I've always been a big gamer, but I've always played more AAA games, you could say that. So I don't have this super extensive indie or obscure background of I played these unknown games which gave me this base. So yeah, my influences are all around me. In the later years, maybe one of the biggest influences for me and my designs have been escape room games, because me and my friends, including Mariona and Javi, have played tons of them. And when I say tons, I mean it. So yeah, room escape games have been a big influence in my design, even if it hasn't been a conscious decision. Otherwise, I would say that maybe the Zelda saga has been a major influence for me also. And I think it doesn't matter what kind of game I am designing. I always like draw some inspiration from there. But yeah, also, as Mariona said, everyday life. When you do this professionally every day, like your mind focuses in a way that you see all things through this design lens or through this art lens in the case of Mariona. So yeah, you cannot stop analyzing things from your new professional perspective.
I get that.
And
yeah,
that would be it.
Yeah, there's something even innocuous, like a squirrel running across a branch of a tree or something. Oh, look how that moves. Why is it Why is it doing that? Why is the tail up like that? I mean, maybe we could all sorts of seemingly innocuous things turn into a major game component. You know, like, I had this great idea. Did you look at the squirrel? I might have done. Okay, next question. What video game developer do you admire most and why?
Oof. Oh my God. I don't tend to admire people that I don't know personally. Yeah, let me elaborate, because if you don't know the person, maybe you build like a myth on that figure of the of the public figure is the thing, the layer, you know. And sometimes people can deceive you, because even if you met them in person, people can deceive you, right? So yeah. if you are not able to contact them and know them, and just you are guided by this public image you know of them, I think it's really, really, really easy to know something at the end or not, but at some point you could discover something that you don't really like about the person. And for me, I think it's important. I know there is people that like to separate the author and the piece, but it's not my case, because I'm so linked to my pieces, I'm so linked to my art, that I cannot separate myself from my creations. So I treat the people in the same way. So I don't separate them, because I cannot separate myself. So for me, it's really important to be confident that I can trust the person in a way. So yeah, I admire people that is in my circle of people I know, my friends. Yeah, I have a lot of people that I really admire for their work, but they are not famous. So I think I cannot answer your question in that fashion.
Indeed. I think one way to interpret it is recognize someone's work. Mm-hmm. Now, I grant you, you still have that's fine. You can recognize someone's what they've done, what they've produced, and treat it in itself. But if you are of the opinion, and that's perfectly legitimate to say, look, that's fine, I might have done this thing, but look what they did over there, or did, or said, or expressed. And yeah, no, that's fine. There's been many, many examples of this, and we're still going to struggle with it all the time. And the old phrase of never meet your heroes, I believe, mm-hmm. is linked to that. And that's a fair point. But as I said, this place is more of about recognizing the craftsmanship of what someone's done. That's what I'm asking. Again, if you can't separate that, that's fine, and that's legitimate. But, okay, thanks very much for the honesty on that, Mariana. Jordi, did you want to chip in on this one?
Yes, I will. But I will ask you something as I answer.
Yes.
Because I have a problem, which is I'm totally unable to remember names of anyone. To give you an example, I've been listening to my favorite metal band for decades now, and I have only been able to memorize the name of the lead singer, and I cannot get into my head the names of anyone else in the band. So I know the games, but I am totally unable.
Well, you can cite the games, and then we can say, okay, that's fine.
I will say the games, and I will say why I think their creators are people that I admire. But yeah, I admire them in their anonymity, because in my head they don't have a name, right?
Well, we can get the listener to research for themselves who made these games. That's fine.
Okay. So the thing is, I admire people who I think set to do the game that they wanted to do, and they didn't look at what others were doing. So that's the thing that I admire the most. So in this category, I could say some games like Dwarf Fortress, like Tunic, like Braid, like Celeste, like, I don't know, many games would come to mind if I give it a thought. All these games for me have something in common, and it's that they were not following a trend. Sometimes they just put all the resources they had into realizing this vision they had for the perfect game in their minds, and they set up to do that. I think this is the same mindset that we have at Mango Protocol. We really, and sadly, never expect to get rich making games, because every game we make is just the game that we feel like making at that time. If you look at our catalog, you will see that the first two games are point-and-click adventures, but our third game was a beat-em-up. And we changed genres super drastically because we felt like the story we wanted to tell needed to be in the form of a beat-em-up, even if we didn't have a previous experience with this genre, but we really felt inside that that's what we wanted to do. So it really resonates with me when I play games that make me feel this way when playing them, like, hey, this person or this group of people where they were just thinking about making this original and awesome game that they had in their minds, and they set to do it and they managed to. And of course, sadly, we only get to play the ones that made it, because some of them die along the way. But yeah, that I think that's the kind of devs that I admire. I'm sorry I cannot give their names. I'm sure you can guess. Well,
Lucas Pope, the example of doing Papers, Please. You know, sure. That's the kind of person, you know, like, So, right, okay. Great answers. Last question then of the first half. Here we go. I asked this question to demonstrate that you're not living in a bubble. What are you playing right now?
I am halfway, well, not halfway. I already finished, but I'm on, like, in the end game of Eastward Octopia DLC. Is the farming DLC from Eastward. And also, I am on the edge of finishing Carto. It's a puzzle game, really, really chill, really, really, yeah, really cute on my things. And also, I need to finish Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. I need to kill Ganon, but I don't want to. So these are the three things, like, I'm, like, playing. Like, they are open right now.
Nice. Okay. What about you, Jordi?
I would like to say I'm playing more than I am, but I have a four-year-old daughter, and my playtime has been obliterated since the months before she was born. But yeah, the little time I have now, I won a PS5 in a raffle. Believe it or not, and I was super stoked. so yeah, I got some PlayStation exclusive that I have wanted to play for a long time. So yeah, in the last months I finished Horizon, and now I'm playing Horizon Forbidden West because I like the first one very much. Well, the second one has been a bit disappointing until now, but I'm only like 10% in, so I hope things get better. And also in parallel, last night I bought this Vampire Survivors like that is based on the Deep Rock Galactic franchise. They launched it, I think it was on the 14th, and yeah, I had a couple of runs, and it's funny. It's a fun game, but I don't think I will be playing for the long run, but it's pretty cool.
Nice. Yeah, I liked Horizon, the first one. I still haven't got around to the second one, but I do need to get onto that. But, you know, distractions. Well, that's the end of the first half. Well done. You made it. Let's move on to the second half of the show, where we're going to be delving deep into Clem. Thank you. The first question isn't really a question, it's a request. Could you tell us, what is Clem?
We like to say Clem is a Puzzlevania adventure. This is a term we came up with early in the development because it is a puzzle adventure, more or less classic stuff. You walk around the house picking up objects, combining them, using them to solve puzzles. But at the same time, you unlock these magic toys that give you new skills and abilities. And with them, you can backtrack to the places you already visited and tackle some puzzles in a different way, or maybe open a path that was closed. So that's why we thought the Vania concept was fitting with what Clem is in a mechanical way, in the way that it plays. And regarding the story, is a bit of a dark and cute story, a mystery one at that. So maybe you should tell us what degree of spoilers are you expecting in our answers, because for the people to really enjoy the experience, we don't like to spoil the story very much. But
no, I think on the Sausage Factory, we're more about how. So we're very much about, you know, okay. The content is something we try to avoid. We like to actually push the guests to figure out how to describe their stuff in abstract terms without going into the content. It can be done. But yeah, we don't do content here because you're right. We're going to let the players discover that for themselves.
So yeah, I'll just leave it. It's a dark, somehow melancholic story. Mm-hmm. You have to unveil, and it has some personal things buried into it.
Yeah.
Let's leave it there.
So at the very beginning, the player takes on the person or the character or controls a little doll-like being, soft toy with a button for an eye and the other one's missing, and yeah, he's got a zip on the back of his head. That's not a spoiler. That's what happens at the very beginning of the game. It's just like, that's it. It's what you are. And you're controlling this. And there's a voice that keeps on advising you and telling you asking you to do things. No, telling you to do things, to retrieve things for them. And this voice is fairly, it's not all the time. No. Don't think that, everyone. It's not all, that would be ridiculous. But it appears just at the right moments. We'll talk about that later in the show. But I think that's pretty good summary. It's a very melancholic, dark, but also black comedy kind of thing, because there is some pathos. In fact, there's a lot of pathos in Clem. And it's sort of like it leads you into a false sense of security. It's one of those games where you think, oh, I know, I can see the measure of this. I know what's going on. No, you don't. No. No, you don't. It doesn't just pull one rug from underneath you. It's constantly doing it. You know, it's one of those games. The best adventure games is you just when you think you've got it, when you think, oh, I know how this is going to work. No, you don't. No, it's wonderful. So my first design question for you is this. As with all good adventure games, and Clem is most definitely one, it revels in the need to apply lateral thinking all of the time. If you're stuck, it probably means you're not doing that. It's not a judgment against the player, or indeed, you do a wonderful job of encouraging the player when they're doing that. But that's something that's really focused in on how you solve the puzzles within the adventure. Can you talk me through how you have designed Clem in such a way is to ensure that the player is gently introduced to this concept, more to the point of how they are to interact with the world and what things they have to do in order to know what the limits of what you can and can't do, because that's the core tenet of puzzle games. If you're thinking outside the parameters of what you can do, then that's not a solution to the puzzle. And I see that so often, so many people go, oh, maybe if I touch that, and like, No, you can never touch that normally. So why are you talking about that now? So tell us, how have you done that? I just want, because I think it's a fantastic job you've done here, but I want you to expand on it. How did you do that? It's basically, in other words, how did you onboard the player?
Okay, I think I will answer this. Well, I will try. So as I mentioned before, we are super into escape rooms. And I think this influence is something that helped us a lot with one of the design pillars that we were like coming to again when we were working on the design. And it is that all things have to make sense, but we didn't want them to be super obvious. So we work with this, it has to make sense. Every puzzle has to be really well integrated into the story and into the environment. We don't want things to feel alien for the player. And on the other side, how can we manage to keep this lateral thinking that you were talking about? How do we manage to make the player think in a different way to approach this, but don't get lost in the many things that they would be thinking about? And this is when the notebook comes into play. We really, really try to reinforce this behavior from the very beginning. When you're lost, when you're in doubt, just open the notebook, because this notebook is not only some source of some blank thing that you are using to write notes in it. This notebook used to belong to someone who knows more than you. So by extension, the notebook sometimes knows more than you do, because what you write on the notebook, how can I say this? The character that you are controlling knows more things than it thinks it knows, because it has some knowledge, some memories, some input from the person that made it. So every time it takes the notes on the notebook, it is giving itself clues to progress without them knowing. So I think I'm getting lost here, but
that's fine. No, it's very difficult to explain, but really, yes, you're right. And I deliberately didn't mention the scrapbook, because that's just as integral to the rest of the game as actually moving around and interacting with objects. It's an extension. It's over and above the mere inventory and space. Most adventure games have inventory and space. That's it. They don't have their own notebook, because typically, certainly back in the history of adventure games, they expect you to write that yourself.
Exactly.
But I'm going to go into that later on in a later question. But thanks for bringing it up. I appreciate it, because I was happy that you did, because you're right. If anything, Clem is anchored around the scrapbook. It really is. All roads lead to it, so to speak. I want to talk about the hint system now in Clem. There is one, everyone, but it is not obtuse. It's not sort of, do you want a hand? That kind of thing. You very cleverly realise that when a player is behaving a certain way or doing certain things, then you go, there's nothing here, really. And it's like, you just tell them, rather than going, faffing around and trying to do something in the space. They're like, you've done everything here that's required. That really threw me. I even stopped playing. I put the controller down, like, wow. That's just so unusual for an adventure game developer to point to the player and tell the player, you're wasting your time here. I don't know of really ever seeing that. Normally it's just nothing, silence. They just let you career around and do silly things. In your game with Clem, no. I respect your time, player. Okay, there's nothing here. Go somewhere else. You don't tell them where to go. No, but you say, not here. And that's great. Could you tell us how was this configured? How did you come up with this idea of monitoring the player's actions and helping them that way?
This was a little bit implemented later on the development, because we test the game I must say, since the beginning of we have something showable, let's say, and we see the people, how they play. And we got this system where the you have the boys that in the beginning was more, I don't know how to say it, but she was not pleasant. She was not nice to you. She was like, she was treating you like a thing, right? And people start to complain about the boys being annoying. Like, yeah, the boys is super annoying. I don't like her. I hate her. And we noticed that wasn't a good thing for the game. So we repurpose like all this audio. We re-record it again with a different tone, with a different voice mood, and we channel it into helping the people, not making them feel bad about how they were playing. And this is where Javi, the programmer, find these little things that we can notice during your gameplay, like if you are stuck in a place doing nothing, like no notebook open, no movement, nothing. We can assume like you are thinking, or maybe like you are looking on internet or something, right? So that is a good moment, for example, to give you a hint that maybe you are not in the right place for the thing you are trying to do, because we can also see like how is your progress going, right? So yeah, we try to make these things more in a pleasant way and make the player feel like the voice is helping, the voice is something useful and not something hateful.
Yeah, yeah. However, she is helpful because it's a female voice, a young female voice, but it's still a taint of malevolence there.
We cannot forget that maybe she's trying to get something out of you.
Yeah.
Maybe she's trying to manipulate you in a nice way.
Yeah.
But she wants something from you, and she's trying her best to get what she wants. But yeah, in a good way, not in a bad way.
Indeed.
Yeah, I would like to add something to this. To this closed system explanation, and I think in the end what we tried to do was like to translate the experience we had while bringing the game to public events before the game was launched. We had already seen like hundreds, maybe thousands of people try the game, and we knew where people got stuck. So in the end, the closed system. Maybe it's like a projection of what we were doing in real life when we saw someone stuck, because you're watching them play and you don't want them, you don't want to give them the clue immediately, because you want to see what mental processes they are following to try and solve these puzzles. So yeah, in the end, I think the voice is like a projection of Mariona, Javi, and me walking behind your back, like watching what you are doing, and Javi like programming these moments when the voice is like, hey, maybe you should look somewhere else. There's a couple places that I really like the hints that the voice gives you. And there are places when you have to take more than one object from a drawer or from inside a box. And this only happens like in two places in the game. So the player is not used to picking up more than one item when they open a container, let's say it. So we added these two instances of the voice reminding you when you exit the room, the voice tells you, hey, I think you forgot something inside that drawer, or maybe you have to come back and look again.
Right, right.
And it also reinforces the feeling of you thinking, okay, so the voice is not only speaking inside my head, maybe she's able to see what I am seeing, because she knows that I just opened a drawer and I left something inside of it.
Yeah.
It works in different levels.
And you can't see her either, which is really alarming, but let's not go there. But I want to talk about the scrapbook more, because the scrapbook in Clem enables you as the author communicate really complex ideas, really way and over and above anything you can do with the player interaction and the environment within the confines of Clem's interface. It's a flip screen, single static screen. You're walking around within a static screen, and then you move on to the next one. That's how it's presented. So that's the limit of the player interface. So the scrapbook really gives you an avenue to communicate and explain things over and above. So how much reliance have you placed on the scrapbook? Have you found during the development of Clem to really expand the world beyond the confines of the space that the player's in?
All of it.
Yeah.
we rely on the notebook for a ton of things. As you progress, and if you start rereading the notes that you have taken of puzzles that you have already solved or situations that you have already been through, you will notice that we try to blend many things inside the information. Many clues. They are not just clues, but a mixture of a clue and some lore for the story. So the book is the line that you have to follow, the rope that you have to grab to follow the story, because there are no dialogues in this game, and all the story is told through the objects you find and through the notes you take in the notebook. So it was really, 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 really important, and we put a lot of work. Javi is not only the programmer, he's the narrative director. So between the three of us, we put a lot of work into making every picture and every line inside the notebook contain information in different levels.
Yeah, there's one particular puzzle that can only be solved, that I remember, by reading a rather large tranche of text. It's very well written and laid out. I'm not going to say what it is, because that's spoiling, but it just really, you get to sit there and just read through this and really understand it. Understand it's not only what the word is written, but what it's trying to tell you. It's what isn't written is more important, what is. And it's really clever, and I just felt, you know, had to raise the prominence of the scrapbook. Yes, it's a static thing, although it's beautifully animated when it's flipped between the screen in each one, but it's page, I should say. But yeah, I think it's a marvelous thing.
Yeah, for this puzzle in particular, I think we have to thank Javi's efforts, because I designed the basic logic behind it, but then we had to work really hard to make it make sense inside the story and transform something that initially was like a bit foreigner to the game into a nice story between some characters that gives you like a ton of background information about them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then hidden between the lines are the clues to solving the puzzle.
Last question. The use of shadows and subtle animation is used to provide clues to the player, more to the point, what Clem wants, so to speak, to sort of guide them as to maybe they should look at that, maybe you should, well, that's strange, what happened there? That's sort of, it's not static, you know, you go into a space and then something happens. You see something in the corner of your eye and like, what was that? And you go following it. Is their introduction more narrative or informative, or basically both?
I would say both, but maybe the narrative part is more important, because if you look close and you remember all these off things you see around the house, when you finish the game, you will understand a lot of things that happen in the end. It's okay if you don't get it, because they're just informative, just to give you more information about what is happening. You will understand, of course, what it is at the end, but it gives you like the strings to make a nice lace, a nice ribbon in the end. So yeah, I think both, but more in the narrative side.
Yeah, I really like them. really did. It meant that there was something going on other than me, and that's important. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not the center of the universe as much as you'd like to be, and there's other things going on that people are doing things, or maybe not doing things, and maybe they just want to help, maybe they're not. Depends, doesn't it? But there's the subtle little hints of, and also, and I'm going to leave this last question with this, and it's a wonderful response to this question, but this time is progressing in a very strange way, and or maybe it isn't progressing. Yeah, time in this, in Clem, is not linear. So let's leave it at that. Leave it at that. So Clem has been developed by Mango Protocol. It's a great name for a studio. Where does it come from?
Oh, I really like this question. Because we are a little bit silly. I cannot hide it. No, seriously, we really want to, when we were thinking about names for the studio, we were like a little bit concerned about something that sounded cool or was even easiest enough for the people to remember. So we came up like, okay, mango is a fruit that is said and write in different languages the same way. So you can say mango in Spanish and mango in English. It's almost the same. So yeah, it made it like a really international friendly name. And also I think it's the best fruit in the world. So that made like a nice point about our opinions. And nice. Also the second part is protocol. So a fruit is, it's cool, but it doesn't give you the hint of something technological. So we choose to mix it, to combine it with protocol as an exchange of ideas. And that's a kind of a protocol. Yeah. And that it's like the mango protocol, like this creative process we have here, like the best fruit and something with technology.
Nice. Well, works with Apple. Anyway,
Apple is boring.
And, they are a bit, aren't they? It's just tedious. And it's published by Iceberg Interactive. And what platforms is Clem available on?
It is available on PC, on Steam, on GOG, and on Epic, if I'm not mistaken. And it's also available for Nintendo Switch. And it will be available at some point in the near future for PlayStation and Xbox.
Excellent. Okay. Well, that's Clem. And I have to say, wonderful game. Jordi and Marione, it's been wonderful having you on the show. It genuinely has. You've been very open and honest and expanded a great deal on the creation of Clem. It's an extraordinary game. Thank you for making it. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having us, Chris. It's been delightful talking to you.
Well, I enjoyed that. I hope you all did. Next week, episode 491 features Zero Cyvert, a survival adventure game by Carbo Studio. I talked to Luca Carbonera, the sole creator of Zero Cyvert, about development of that game. It's a really interesting one. We really go into the woods with it. You realise that's a pun when you find out about the game. Anyway, let's listen to me pre-recorded self. Bye!
You have been listening to the Sausage Factory podcast, part of the Kane and Rince Collective. Support us for just $2 per month at patreon.com/Kane and Rince for early, extended and exclusive podcasts. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Twitch, YouTube, and at our website, kaneandrince.com.